first case in our calendar is 04757, Pamela McMillan versus Flow Polymers, Inc. Mr. Potash.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm going to try to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Lester Potash, and I am here on behalf of Pamela McMillan in what is an unemployment compensation claim. The issue essentially is whether there was just cause for Pamela McMillan to leave her employment, but I think if you take a look at the way the facts have been presented and the way the courts have viewed this case, it's more whether the job left Pamela McMillan. In this situation, and as has been described both in the County Police Court and the Court of Appeals, we have a young lady that started her career at this company, started as a secretary, worked for 12 years, achieved upper management status, made over $50,000 a year, was a national sales director for a company that deals with the rubber and tire industry in a multi-billion dollar setting, dealing with the top companies internationally. She has a 4% stake in the company, and she has authority to do various and sundry things. All of a sudden, there's a management change, and without any discussion, without any questions, without any input from her, the rules change. And the rules change not so much as a business judgment decision, but as you can see from what happened below, this was more or less a left turn as relates to the way they conducted business. In other words, the contracts that Pamela McMillan negotiated with the various companies, where she signed on the dotted line when she gave the company's word for prices and other commitments, those were unilaterally changed. These were not subject to discussion. They didn't ask for her input. They didn't ask for anything about her. All they did is say, well, we've decided that we're going to change the prices, and that's the way it is. The various activities that she sponsored on the company's behalf, the various programs, the various seminars, the various other activities, they decided unilaterally we're going to do away with that. Every aspect of her career with this company over the 12 years was turned around. They then changed her position to a marketing manager, that which she really wasn't fit for. She didn't really have the experience, so they're dealing now with products as opposed to selling. And they expect at this point, having destroyed her reputation with the people with whom she's dealt, having taken away the responsibility she's had, having really turned around every aspect of her employment, she then says, you know, maybe this isn't a good fit anymore. And it's not because she disagreed with the fact that they priced some widgets at a certain price. It's because they have pretty much destroyed her opportunity to function with that company. So the question really becomes, how long or how or should a person be required to remain with an employer that pretty much doesn't want them? I mean, if you take a look at what all they did, they basically gave her the invitation to leave, and she accepted it. And it wasn't, they didn't have a big fight, a big argument. They had a discussion in July. They came and they told her these things. She said, you know, this isn't really working. I wish the company well. I'll stay I'll stay to the end of the month if you'd like me. And they say, no, leave now. So this pretty much gives you an idea as to what it was the company's position in connection with their wanting Pamela McMillan to stay.
Counsel, the facts of this particular case, as you articulate them, it does seem that at least in her contact with the people with whom she did business and with whom she had promised a product at a certain price, that her credibility was undermined. And you quote some folks who say, well, you know, it'll be a cold day when we want to do business with your company. So I see that aspect of it. But we have to write in this case instead of just deciding one unemployment compensation case, we have to write, and the test that your brief seems to suggest, or I don't know that you suggest a test, but how do we write something that just doesn't leave everybody who is in any kind of an unhappy situation with a company collect unemployment compensation if they choose to leave?
This isn't a dispute between an employee and management as to what to do or how to do it specifically. This is a fundamental change by a company that, as you indicated, not only undermined her position, but when Pamela McMillan signed on the dotted line, she didn't sign her name, she signed the company's name. When she represented herself to Bridgestone or to Michelin or to Pirelli, she represented the company. As soon as the company undercut her, said, your word is no good, they destroyed her ability to function. How do you write something? First of all, the question is, was there just cause for her to leave? Under the facts of this case, the answer is yes. On a broader scale, and this is the question, you know, if Ms. McMillan came to, let's say, the board of directors, let's say seven members of the board of directors and said, you know what I did? You know those contracts that we had in force? I changed them. I raised the price. You know those seminars that we normally give to all our customers? I canceled them. You know all the other activities that we did to interact with our suppliers? They're no longer here. I did this on your best interest without consulting you. They'd show her the door and tell her not to let it hit her on the way out, and who's going to grant her unemployment compensation benefits? Nobody. It's reversed. The company did this to her. They did not have just cause to terminate. In essence, this
they own the company.
Well, fine. And what's interesting is that in the briefs they say, well, people can sue the company. Well, that's great for the lawyers. The question is that the way we do business? You know, if you want a fundamental business ethic code, if you give your word, keep it. That's it. Whether you can get sued, whether you drive yourself into bankruptcy is the company's business, but you have an employee that's affected by this. And so the question now becomes, how is the employee to act? How long do you stay with the ship? If the ship is sinking, do you stay there with the captain? Or is there a time when maybe you should part company?
But the problem becomes, because I voted to take this, but that we don't try to just decide one case, one unemployment compensation claimant. So if the case is here and we're going to write on it, then we have to leave some behind, some rule that is benefit and guidance to everyone. And I'm having a hard time discerning what that is, what that rule is that doesn't, if we were to rule in your favor and benefit your client and still doesn't leave management everywhere wondering how can we run our companies and make decisions without running the risk that somebody is going to leave and stick us with unemployment compensation?
Well, you do that with every decision you write. You discern what it is that's important to the issue, and you emphasize those, and you make that.
So what would you have us say?
Well, first of all, one thing I would have you say is that there is a sense, you know, is there such a thing as business ethics? I would think that there is. What are the business ethics? The business ethics are to conduct yourself in an honorable manner. The fact that they can be sued is immaterial to the issue before Pamela McMillan.
But changing the pricing, the employer changing its pricing policies for reasons totally unrelated to her, is that an ethics question?
Well, the question
we would write law saying that based on this case that you may not, a company may not change its pricing policy if it's going to embarrass or if it's going to undercut something that an employee has negotiated with. Why would that be ethics?
The question is, when did they change it? I agree to do some work for somebody for $300, and all of a sudden, before I'm done, I say, you know, I changed my mind. I'm going to do $600.
I have the same problem, Justice Piper. I was one of the four justices who voted to allow this case in the merits, and I'm wondering now why I did, frankly, because as I read the case on the merits, it's factual. I mean, there's a letter from her, apparently in the record, a glowing letter about the company, hoping they have a great future when she's resigning. There's another allegation that she, you know, that she left for other reasons, but there's no evidence. There's nothing tangible for that. This is a factual case.
Actually, the letter that she wrote demonstrates the kind of person that she is. She didn't have to write a letter that says the company stinks. I hope you all drown. She didn't have to say, I'm leaving, I'm taking my stuff, and goodbye and good luck. She did this thing because she's a decent person. She invested 12 years here. The question is, she's not happy about leaving. She didn't have anywhere else to go. This is not a career move. you know, she didn't advance herself. This is a situation where she could no longer function. And to try to answer your question, the issue is, does a company have a responsibility to an employee? The employee has a duty of loyalty to a company. Does a company have a responsibility or duty of loyalty to an employee? And if the company does have a duty of loyalty, then, under the facts of this case, did they breach it? Did they, in the term, again, this was not after the contract expired.
Are you suggesting that the company should not have changed its pricing policies because it would have embarrassed her if it had? Is that the flip side of your issue?
That's only one issue here. There were a variety of factors that, remember, this is in a very short period of time. The management changed in March. All of a sudden, all of these things happen at the same time. It's as if you know, and again, two judges sort of agreed, two didn't, and two didn't was Court of Appeals, but two of them did agree that there were other factors to be considered that warranted the receipt of these benefits.
Counsel,
are you saying that the company did these management changes and the policies that were implemented subsequent to the management change to purposely act detrimentally to your client's reputation, or is that an incidental consequence of the bigger picture of McMillan restructuring?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know if you believe in coincidences, but everything that was going on affected her. There was nothing else that they talked about that didn't affect Pamela McMillan. It was all of these things, the evidence, I mean, the incidences that we developed during the course of the proceedings, all of them focused on her. And so I don't know, and nobody ever said, you know, this was just one piece in a tremendous overhaul restructuring of our corporation. When Mr. Searles testified, there was nothing else that he talked about as to what the company was going to do for a bigger and better future. Everything was focused on how they restructured her situation. Almost, again, she's leaving. Nobody said, well, is there anything we do to keep you? Or there was no conversation, no evidence, nothing to reflect the fact that they wanted her to stay. Again, you can infer what you wish.
So your brief seems to suggest this. It's your contention that on pricing of products that she had priced out to the various customers of the company previously, that instead of saying we need you to notify Goodyear or Bridgestone or whoever that next January we're going to be looking at a significant price increase, they said instead you got to do it right now, affecting the price of a product that there was no contract between this company and customers, right?
There was.
A written contract?
Oh, sure. It's in fact, it's cited in the brief. Had she committed to a price for a year, she had in writing. And Cameron Frazier had in writing, had committed to pricing, yes. And why wouldn't that be something the company should honor? Well, we have a problem, and they go on and on
so
and on.
So she, by letter or something, had committed to the company?
Contracts. I mean, this is a legal document.
All right.
And they keep talking about, well, we could get sued. Swell, but that's not the issue here. And you went one step higher than I submit. They didn't call her in and say, this is what we want you to do. They called her in and said, this is what we have done. And they didn't even say, deal with it. They didn't ask for her input, or they didn't even ask for her suggestions. Will you please contact these people and say, because of the problems, we'd like to renegotiate? That wasn't the way. Had they proceeded differently, maybe there would have been a different result. Maybe she'd still be with the company. The point is, they acted unilaterally to do all they could to make sure she left. They didn't want to fire her outright, so they did it indirectly. And I'm hoping that I have any time reserved for rebuttal, so I will stop right here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Portash. Mr. Carney.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Stephen Carney for Attorney General Jim Petro and the Department of Job and Family Services. The problem in this case, of course, is that there is no workable objective standard that would tell employers what to do if Ms. McMillan wins here. This isn't just an ordinary case where an employer would think, as in other areas of the law, I'm not always 100% sure whether what I would do crosses a line or not. This is a case where if an employer tried to listen to its employees on prices, by definition, personal opinions on ethics are diverse. You'd have 100 employees driving you in 100 different directions. Boss, we got to raise prices or we're going to go out of business and none of us will have jobs. No, boss, we can't raise prices. No, boss, we can't do this. We can't do that. We shouldn't buy any of our widgets from China. They have human rights violations there. I'm shocked by this. And I try to imagine.
Well, this woman alleges that what they did is unilaterally break contracts that she had negotiated for the company and then leave her to go out and deal with it.
Well, Your Honor,
that would be a pretty tough situation for any employee.
Your Honor, that fails on both the facts and the law. First, on the facts, despite the tossing around loosely the term contracts, the record shows there was not a contract in any situation. No contract was entered in the record, or no testimony that customers who had already ordered, I'd like 300 packets at this price, were all of a sudden told the next day, no, here's your invoice, the price is doubled. But these are pricing lists that are sent out, where they say, these are going to be our prices this year. Let us know when you place an order. For people who hadn't placed orders.
That was the impression I had of it, yes.
Right. These are pricing lists that were sent out, and they said, you know what? Mid-year, we're going to change the prices. Now we're going to do this. Some companies change prices every week. Gas stations do it every day. This isn't someone who is midway in pricing at the pump. You know, this is someone who sends out a new pricing list, and then she says, well, we can't keep our customers happy at these higher prices. But that's a lot different from broken contracts. The other thing is to recognize that, of course, here the court has a deferential standard to the agency, to the Unemployment Review Commission, and they did not find that there are any contracts broken. There were no contracts entered in the record. But even if there were, if you're looking at guidance for future cases, even if a company were to breach a contract, that kind of decision, unlike violating perhaps a criminal law or some public law, in business dealings, companies, unfortunately, if they get behind, and again, this didn't happen here, but if you've only got so much product left and you have to decide, oh, geez, do I satisfy this order or that order, you know, one employee might say, well, let's send it to our best customer. Another might say, no, let's send it to the mom and pop because they'll be out of business if they don't have it. You know, our entire federal bankruptcy system is set up to find a way to get out of a bunch of contracts. If a company does breach a contract, it then pays the cost, you know, if it has a breach of contract suit. But every employee can't step up to the plate and say, well, no, I want to do it this way. Opposing counsel, you know, used the phrase, well, how long do you stay with a sinking ship? Well, we couldn't have every deckhand running up and saying, no, let's steer this way, let's steer that way. I mean, that's the best way to hit the iceberg is to have five hands trying to steer at the same time.
Let me ask you a proposition of law that we're asked to adopt, and I'll sort of paraphrase, an employee has just cause to leave employment where employer's policies and practices adversely and materially undermine the employee's credibility, reputation, or ability to effectively perform her duties. If we were to adopt that as a principle of law, would that give difficulty to the Unemployment Compensation Board or to employers in understanding how it should be applied?
Absolutely, because every aspect of that is subjective. Adversely affect the reputation, according to whom? I think people won't believe me anymore. I think people won't like this. Or undercutting my ability to do the job. Well, you know, if I had a faster computer, boss, I could get more work done for you. A lot of us might think our employers could do more to help us succeed or more to help us do this or that. But ultimately, if an employer doesn't give employees enough tools, it's the employer that's going to suffer. If sales really go down.
But this says, we're looking at it from an unemployment compensation just cause for leaving. Materially undermine the employee's credibility, reputation, or ability to effectively perform her duties. If an employer acts in such a way as to take, not the facts in this case, but this is an abstract issue of law, if an employer acts in that way, could that be just cause in some other case?
I don't think so, Your Honor, unless you had an objective standard where an employer would know ahead of time, we can't ask this of employees. So the way we structure the propositional law in our brief is we think there are two ways to approach it. First, the first thing the court should do is simply address this in the negative, saying an employee's personal preferences or policy disagreements are not enough for just cause. And if you just say that much and no further, we'll at least know, and all the lower courts will know, personal preferences are not enough. Cases like this are outside of the unemployment compensation scheme. If, on the other hand, the court does feel the need to try to go further and say, well, what would be enough? When would it be just cause? I think you'd have to say, if an employer asks an employee to violate a criminal law or a binding code on an industry, you know, generally accepted accounting practices, the code of professional responsibility, if a partner asks an associate, do something unethical, that sort of thing, where everyone knows, here's the black letter law, or here's the OSHA standard or the EPA standard, don't ask somebody, help me dump this chemical in the creek, and don't tell anyone. If there were objective standards that are knowable, but when you talk about undermining my reputation, that is, not only subjective, but it's something where, again, one employee might say, you know, you're hurting our reputation as a company that cares because, you know, we're here at Mitchell's and we're serving meat. You know, I very much respect people who are vegetarians, but well, I think they recognize they can't impose that.
Most cases involving just cause are subjective, are they not? The Unemployment Compensation Board of Review has to, I would guess, most of their docket is filled with cases in which they have to make a decision on the facts, that subjective determination. How is this different?
Your Honor, other cases are definitely very fact-bound, but even in a fact-bound case, you can say, as the standard says, what would a reasonable person of ordinary intelligence do here? And there's a difference between saying, what would a reasonable person do that we all agree with, sort of the reasonable person as a universal standard of no one should be negligent here, no one should turn that corner that fast, versus saying, we can all reasonably respect the views of someone who says, I don't want to buy anything made in China because I object to that. But I think we all agree that we can't reasonably expect that that's a universal standard. And there's a difference between subjective in the sense of hard to call balls and strikes versus subjective of everybody has a different opinion. And here, an employer wouldn't just find it hard to meet the target, they'd find themselves pulled in opposite directions. You'd have one employee saying one thing and another employee saying another. We have to lower prices to bring in sales. No, we have to raise prices to make more revenue. Whichever way I go, somebody's going to have a claim against me here for unemployment compensation if my different employees disagree. I mean, ultimately, the question here is, you know, who owns the company, as Justice Resnick noted. You know, they own the company. They have to make these decisions, just
Counsel,
as here.
You're really asking us to reaffirm the constructive discharge rule as it's understood with regard to objective criteria, are you not?
Exactly. And because this case is, in our view, so far afield from what would trigger a just cause, I don't think this case provides a good vehicle to actually try to say just cause is satisfied, an employee has a reason to quit where X, Y, and Z happen. I think the best thing to say is simply to phrase it in the negative of an employee's subjective preferences, where people, reasonable minds could disagree, is raising prices a good idea or a bad idea, is not enough. And if the court just says that's not enough, that's, I think, all you can do with this case. I think it would be overreaching to try to figure out what would be enough and cover the next 10 hypothetical cases till a case comes up that's closer to the pin. And the example I most try to imagine that I think we'd all be familiar with is here, this court decides things every day, and that's your job. Seven of you get to vote, but certainly, you know, your staff or, you know, your court reporter couldn't read the decision while he's editing it. You know, he does a fine job at that, but he couldn't say, I can't believe you're putting out this decision. I'm going to make that reversed instead of affirmed. I don't think that's how that works, But seriously, I don't mean to be flip about that, but every employee at some point has disagreed with something their employer has done. I can't think of a single field where someone hasn't at some point.
I think this does come down to factual on this case. It seems that the employee is arguing that, at least from what she can see, the only big change in this company had to do with things that, to use her term, just totally undermined her. And in other words, from her perspective, they were looking for anything that just left her feeling like she is out on a limb with no support, with the people that she has to deal with, and that didn't happen to anybody else
in the company.
Well, the problem is with that.
So I think that's their argument, that they targeted her.
To be honest, Your Honor, that was sort of a surprise to me. I knew they were arguing for a subjective standard. I didn't think I'd picked up in the briefs this theory that they raised prices sort of just to undercut her. It's not as if there was a Pam McMillan pricing sheet and everyone else got to sell the widgets for a buck and they were $5 for her. They raised the prices across the board. There were other people in the company who had to sell at this price.
So that's factual, and we're not going to make that call.
I don't think they dropped the prices right after she left.
If you had a case like that, then does that meet the test as Chief Justice Moyer articulated?
I think if you actually had a case where someone was targeting and, you know, there were these emails back and forth of how can we get Joe to leave the company, then what you would say at some point is this wasn't even a quit for just cause, so the question wouldn't be, was there just cause to quit or not? The question would be, was she just outright fired?
Well, you rarely find, I mean, amazingly they do sometimes find emails like that, but to assume, claim it just establishes a fact pattern.
I think the smarter thing for that claimant to do would be to stick around, get fired, and argue, because the standard does say in the law, if they fire you without just cause, and then the employer has to show, well, here's the reason we fired you, here's where your performance was slipping, and if they don't have a record of why her performance is slipping, they can't justify the firing. I think quitting, you're always risking when you walk out that, yeah, when you quit, it looks like you quit, because you said the words, I quit. And trying to show, well, I didn't really quit, I was forced out, does mean I think we have to have an objective standard that's first knowable to employers, second, doesn't set up competing interests between employee X who wants to go in this direction, employee Y who wants to go in that direction, and something that the commission can apply from case to case.
Do we need to articulate that standard then in this case, Mr. Carney?
Again, Your Honor, no. I think what the court can articulate is to say subjective personal policy preferences are not enough and leave for another day what would be enough. I think it's too hard to try to say what would trigger when you don't have a fact pattern that even comes close to the pin. I think you need a better case. If you had somebody where there was a binding ethical code, but the question was, is it really binding, it's regulatory, it's from a civil agency, those might be a tougher. For instance, in the whistleblower statute, there's by comparison, if you violate a statute, or in the public policy tort claims that this court's recognized, you have to show a clearly stated policy in the law that's being violated. Here, price increases.
So you would be looking for a statement from this court that based on the circumstances here as articulated by the chief, it doesn't rise to the level of compensation for termination for just cause.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I'd phrase it in terms of here and in any case where it's simply a matter of a policy disagreement. Don't raise prices, don't lower prices.
If you work for a bank and you're told in this part of town we charge more for our loans.
If that part of town is based on perhaps, you know, racial considerations like in the redlining cases that do involve that, that violates, but there are federal laws on the books and there are regulations in the banking industry that actually say don't do that. There's case law where people have been sued for that. There are federal regulations, state regulations. There are codes that say don't do that, just like don't dump this chemical in a creek. But if there's something that hasn't been outlawed and someone just says, I think this is really, really immoral, and again, we can all respect someone's moral difference of why are we buying these products from China? Why are we buying, you know, why are we buying grapes when the workers who pick them aren't treated well? We shouldn't serve grapes in our restaurant. Those are the things where we can all agree there's some strong moral arguments to be made, but it's not illegal. If someone is bringing in a chemical or a fruit or something illegally, yes, and the example you give with banking, if it's just we charge more than the other end of town in general, and someone says, oh my gosh, we're going to lose all our business this way, then that would be this case. If someone says we're charging more in this part of town because of the ethnic makeup of this neighborhood, or that's what the pattern actually shows, then I think you could point to and you could tell your boss, we're violating this federal regulation. And your boss cannot expect you to stand by while you break the law, but the boss can expect you to follow the rules if it's within management prerogative, and that's what the case was here. So we ask the court to affirm the judgment below and to hold that, you know, the boss gets to make decisions, and as long as they don't break the law, and employees have to go along or leave and can't expect us to subsidize their choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Potash, you've saved a minute of your time.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this is not a case about subjective preferences. This is a question about objective acts that have been visited upon this individual and whether she was justified in terminating that relationship. The situation here is fairly clear in that although there's been comments, these are commitments, whatever, if in the hearing itself, the hearing officer asked Mr. Searles, was there recourse? Yes, they can sue us for breach of the contracts, for breach of the pricing commitments, for breach of our word that we had previously given. That was his response, not that there is no legal, that we didn't do anything wrong. And the question becomes, what is illegal? They keep talking about criminal sanctions. However, if you breach a contract, that is a civil wrong. That is something that is, maybe it's common in some industries, but the point is, does one work for a company where they intentionally seek to breach or violate civil commitments, let alone criminal commitments?
Were there other employees that were doing the same or similar job?
As Ms. McMillan?
As Ms. McMillan.
No, she was, and that's the other thing, Your Honor. Ms. McMillan was not a grunt. She was not on the ground floor going out making sales. She was upper management. She was the national sales manager. She was involved in this. This was her territory. So if you're going to affect something like that, I'm not talking about the person who makes the initial sales and they don't like the price sheets and they go on about their business grumbling in their beer. This is the person who is in charge of this, whose word is the company's words. And this is where I submit that the standard that you had talked about applies, because when you talk about just cause, it's the actions that a reasonable person takes to do something or not to do something. That has been the standard. The question is, do these facts fall within the standard?
And they didn't give her any time to sort of ease into these new pricings.
They gave her no time.
They told her this is what we are doing,
like it or lump it. And instead, look, she saw the handwriting on the wall. And so she did the honorable thing. She tendered her resignation with some nice comments about her 12 years of service, offered to stay, and then left. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.